One way to sort of to order spintronics effects is according whether they are spins are injected or detected optically or electronically. Now, the strong point of metal-based spintronics is just the fact that you can do both in an electrical way, sort of electrical detection and electrical injection. And this is basically the GMR and related effects. This is difficult in semiconductors because of, for example, the conductance mismatch problem. But semiconductors can do a lot more things because they are optically active. For example, you could inject things optically and detect electrically. That is the photogalvanic effect, which is being explored by Ganichev, for example. You can do things all optical. You can excite optically and detect optically. These are pump and probe experiments as done in Santa Barbara, for example. It's also possible to inject electrical and detect optically. The spin lead is one example, but electrical injection and detection by, for example, a curl rotation optically is another one. I would like to discuss one of these effects here. But of course, somehow, all these spintronics, which involves optics, is, in my feeling, like wine tasting without being allowed to swallow. It is sort of gives you an unsatisfactory feeling. And there has, of course, been reported some progress by Paul Crowell this Monday, in which he demonstrated that I can do that also in semiconductor spintronics. Things can be done all electrically. I would like to discuss in the second part of my talk about the detection of spin current-induced spins, current-induced spins, like the spin hole effect in an electrical way with ferromagnetic contact.
Derek?
Yes?
Well, I wasn't here on Monday. So
yes?
What was the problem? Is it related to the thing in your box there, GMR?
Yes. I will briefly mention it later. This was, in fact, the electrical Hanle effect. I think Paul Kroll talked about this already at the startup meeting, but he has now also measured really the spin valve effect, just purely electrical without any, he got sort of spin coherence between the two contacts in a non-local geometry. That's a real progress. Okay, so these are the two topics of my talk. The first one is a little bit old, but since Jason Stevens gave a talk about that as experimentalist of the week, and it is related to Paul Crowell's work, I thought I'd repeat it here. The lower part is completely new, and that's not really been published. It's mainly work by Inanç Adagideli, who unfortunately could not be here at this workshop. Okay, in the first part, these are my collaborators, where these ones here did band structure calculations. I would like to show you some nice picture of Arne and Jaroslav, who were here in the beginning of the workshop, during the family service at the Fugio State Beach. By the way, Jaroslav got an offer from UCLA, it seems. So there's a chance that he will be here in the neighborhood in the future. Okay, so the optical detection of spins, I think the nicest way to do is by Faraday rotation. The idea is that you have a crystal with a spin accumulation. You're getting a optical linear polarized light through that. And this is a linear combination of right and left polarized ones, and they are affected by the magnetization, which is parallel to the k-vector, and by sort of changing these coefficients of right and left polarized one, you're basically rotating the plane of this linear polarized light, and this can be measured. So if the magnetization is in plane or sort of normal to the k-vector, you don't see anything. This is usually the case in most experiments. So people use the trick to have a in-plane magnetic field, which then rotates your spin accumulation. Right. Now this gives you a Kerr or Faraday angle, which is oscillating like that in time if you have a pulse signal. Now you can integrate that one, which gives you a Lorentzian curve from which you can fit with two parameters, the A, which is proportional to the spin accumulation itself, and the spin lifetime tau here. These are the main observables in this experiment. Now, this has been pioneered here in Santa Barbara, as you all know. These are experiments in which the oscillations of a spin accumulations are monitored, which have been injected optically in gallium arsenide as a function of the density of electrons, as a function of the doping density. Now, there's the interesting result that this lifetime can be very, very long if you have densities just above the metal insulator transition. And I don't think that there is a proper theory for that yet. Okay, I would like to repeat now the experiments of Jason Stevens and collaborators on interfaces of gallium arsenide and manganese arsenide, which are known to have a Schottky barrier. So this is the device, and I make here a schematic out of it. So manganese arsenide is a ferromagnet, this is N-gallium arsenide, and here is the Schottky barrier. Now you can drive a current through that in two different polarizations, and then you talk about the reverse bias or the forward bias. The standard experiment is reverse bias, where the current, the electrons, are going here from the ferromagnet into the semiconductor, which would be the standard spin injection type of experiment. Now you can. So this would be the reverse bias, but there's also the other possibility, the forward bias, where the electrons go from the semiconductor into the ferromagnet. And it is only in this second configuration that the experimentalists saw something. And they do now this Kerr rotation experiment spatially resolve. So they really scan now this this sample here. And they do this from the back, in fact. They see a spin accumulation under the ferromagnetic contact, precisely under the ferromagnetic contact. So this is the same picture here. And this left edge here corresponds to this left edge here.
You said that you can see the forward bias.
In principle, yes. And Paul Crowell does. But it depends on the magnitude of your Schottky barrier. So here they have a much higher Schottky barrier than Paul has. Now, what's going on? And they had help from Lou here, so they figured out what the physics is, namely its reflection, spin-dependent reflection at this interface, which is, of course, another way of creating a spin accumulation than the standard reflection. Yes?
Does it have the same sign and number for
the impulse experiment? Yeah, that is still, I think, first of all, Paul has iron, and they have manganese arsenide. Now, it was known before that iron and manganese have a different polarization, so this is a problem. But there seems to be that some older experiments in which they compared optically excited spin accumulation in interaction with the ferromagnet seems to indicate that they have a different polarization than what Paul finds. But this is something which is quite difficult because,
Exactly how it affects the impulse of the
Yes, so I think that
the determination of polarization
is not as so the
absolute. Yeah.
So relative polarizations can be easily distinguished, but absolute polarization, the magnitude seems to be different. Okay, so now we refined this picture a little bit in order to, basically in terms of a diffusion equation of the spin accumulation and the current in the bulk, which is then matched at the interfaces. So basically quite similar to the Valle-Fech type model, which is used in metallic spintronics. Now the picture you then get is a simple resistor circuit model in which you have here the spin-dependent interface resistances. This one here is the semiconductor resistance for the spin active region, which is of the thickness of the spin flip diffusion length and the ferromagnet. And obviously, if you have a current bias here and these two resistances are different, you will build up a spin accumulation at the interface. Pardon me? Now, the approximation which you have here is that any spins which are sort of leaking through the interface, they create, in principle, a non-equilibrium distribution at the interface. We assume that this is thermalized. Then you have a spin flip relaxation length into the bulk, but if you are outside the spin flip relaxation length, then it's just a parasitic resistance which is not interesting in the current bias situation. So the spin flip is included in here insofar that we have here a limited resistivity, sort of which is cut short here after the spin flip diffusion. Okay, so you can, this is very primitive theory, you can work it out easily. The spin current can be written like that, where this one here is what happens at the interface, so it's an integral from the conduction band edge of the semiconductor to the Fermi energy, and this is the energy-dependent interface conductances. And this has to be divided by this factor. Now, the conductance mismatch problem says that if this semiconductor conductance is very small, or the resistance is very high, then this is a small number, and this denominator becomes very large, which means the spin current becomes very small. Now, this problem is not so serious if you look for the spin accumulation, because this is just the spin current with a minus sign, and then divided by the conductance of this spin-active region of the semiconductor. Sort of, this neutralizes this effect. And if you look at the spin accumulation, you have much less problems with this mismatch than if you would look at the spin current. Okay, now how can we model this? This is a schematic view of such a Schottky barrier in equilibrium. A Vs is the Schottky barrier height. Now, in the reverse bias, we are trying to sort of tilt up the metal or ferromagnet like that, and we get a strongly suppressed current by the tunneling barrier. In the reverse bias, we are doing the opposite, so we are tilting up the semiconductor. Now, this is the IV characteristic of the experiments. So we see that at low voltages, up to the Schottky barrier, which is about 800 milli electron volts, it's really flat. So there's no current, which means there is no bias here in the semiconductor. It's just flat band. And asymptotically, we can define a flat band condition as that voltage at which the current just starts to flow, which would be somewhere here. You got the bias a little bit higher up. You are screening the Schottky barrier more, so this barrier becomes smaller, the current becomes higher, but you're still in a very nonlinear regime here. Now, unless you go to the fully screened situation, in which, in principle, there should be no barrier anymore, and you're coming into an ohmic regime, which would be the linear regime here. Now, we do not really try to model this in detail. This would be lots of calculations. But qualitatively, this is the picture. Now, what got us interested here is the fact that the spin lifetime turned out to be very strongly dependent on this applied bias. Whereas at the sort of flat band condition, or just above the flat band condition, what you see here is the spin flip diffusion rate as a function of the position, and the ferromagnet is basically here the active part of the ferromagnet. So here you see that the spin flip far away from the contact is not modified, but here it's a strong function of the applied bias, and if you like, of the interface transparency. Now, what we believe is going on here, if you want to model it, you should take into account some complications. It's not simply a one-dimensional situation. This is the actual current flow, and you have here should make the difference between the upspin and the downspin diffusion length as introduced by Michael, Hugh, and Flappe some time ago. But this is also not very essential. Okay, what we believe is the effect, what we saw in the spin flip rate, that it is due to the interaction of the spin accumulation with the ferromagnet, where the spin accumulation has been forced to be non-collinear to the ferromagnet. In that case, we get the so-called spin transfer torque, which had been invented by Berger and by Slonczewski. Now, what is happening in the spin transfer? Now, it can be mapped onto a spin flip scattering, an anomalous scattering, if you like, at the interface from normal metal to a ferromagnet, where the spins here are normal to the magnetization. Now, if you such a scattering process here, you see it on the left side, you have a spin current flowing. On the right side, there is no spin current. So this means the spin current is absorbed. It is absorbed in form of this torque by the magnetization. Now, in this case, the spin accumulation is very small compared to the total magnetization, so the torque will have no active effects on the magnetization, so it will not switch or something like that. But it will still work as a spin dissipation mechanism for the spin accumulation. So this spin current here is absorbed, so the spin accumulation must go down. And this is a simple rate equation like that. So if you want to know what is the effect of this precession, which they do in these Faraday rotation experiments, you must take into account that when the spins are non-collinear, you will have this extra spin dissipation channel. And the spin dissipation will be proportional to the transparency of the interface. Through a tunnel junction, it will not be effective, but through a metallic interface, it can be strong.
They're non-collinear means they're not parallel, if they're anti-parallel.
There is no torque when they're parallel or anti-parallel, but it is when they are 90 degrees. That's very easy to put this, in fact, into a sort of Bloch equation, or if you the spin rate equation of the spins at the interface. You simply look at the balance of the in and outgoing spins, which is carried by the current, which is rotated by the magnetization, and which is dissipated at the interface. You can this work out quite easily, and you find the result of it is exactly the Lorentzian form found by the experimentalist. In terms of a spin lifetime or spin flip diffusion rate again. But this contains now not only the bulk spin flip, but also the interface contribution. Now this is a complicated expression, but in the limit that the interface, that the resistance of the spin active interface region is sufficiently larger than the interface resistance, it becomes a rather simple expression. It looks something like that. And in a good approximation, this equals this 1 divided by Ti. And the Ti, we call the interface spin relaxation time, which is proportional to the electrical resistance of the interface times the density of states of the semiconductor. Now, if we assume that this increase of the spin flip diffusion rate is due to the spin torque effect, but there might be still other processes we don't know about, then you can compare this and you can get the interface resistance out of these experiments. Now, these are the experimental current bias. These are the experimental spin flip diffusion rates. Now we can calculate the corresponding interface resistance, bulk resistance of the semiconductor, and from that we can distill the interface resistance, where S here is the surface area. Now it is useful to translate this into a transparency parameter, kappa, by saying that this interface conductance is kappa times the Sharvin conductance. So the Sharvin conductance would be the conductance if the interface would be completely transparent with a transmittivity of 1. Now we see that indeed that sort of in this low bias, so near to flat band condition, this kappa is very small. We have a very intransparent interface. At high bias, it becomes close to 10% of the ideal value. We can compare this one with first principles calculations, which have been carried out by Kershaw and collaborators. What you see here is manganese arsenide, gallium arsenide interface. And we are looking here at the transparency of such an interface by first principles calculations as a function of the Fermi energy relative to the band edge
for a flat band condition.
Now this is the typical kappas you get, and they are different for the majority and the minority spin. To the left we have a clean interface, to the right we have a dirty interface, where the dirty interface is defined as an interface alloy, random interface alloy, between the ferromagnet, this manganese arsenide, and gallium arsenide. So, we cannot really make a quantitative comparison, but we see that it's reasonable in the same order of magnitude. I would like to point out the following, that in the clean interface, we see that the majority channel has a higher transparency than the minority one. However, if we mess the interface up, we get the opposite. So, I think to really find out what is the polarization of such an interface really depends on all sorts of microscopic details. And the fact that Paul Crowell found a spin accumulation which did not correspond to the expectations, I think there can be lots of microscopic reasons for that. I think it's very difficult to make any hard statements here.
What does it mean, dirty interface?
I said,
this order is within the small layer?
Yes, we have sort of a bimonolayer of interface alloy.
So it's like two-dimensional disorder.
Yes, exactly. So it's just a very simple model of disorder because, that is what the people can handle.
Do you have a simple explanation for the reversal?
Yes, it depends strongly on the symmetry. Because if you have a specular interface, there are only very few bands on which the electrons can go from left to the interface to the right. And this has a certain polarization. If you have rough interfaces, you get diffuse scattering at the interface and sort of a normally incoming electron can scatter in all angles. And this breaks the symmetry, which gives you the positive spin accumulation. You really have then to average over all band and everything can come out. And it depends strongly how you're distributing your electrons over the Brillouin zone into the ferromagnet. Okay. Now here again for Alan, the experiments. That Paul. There are some differences between these experiments and the Stevens experiments. So Stevens had just a ferromagnet, which was manganese arsenide on top of gallium arsenide without any tricks. Paul is using iron, and he is also using here a graded doping, which sort of he started with a strongly doped here under the interface, and then it becomes lightly doped. This seems to be very important to get high transparency of the interface of the Schottky barrier. That is one difference. Another difference is that he is imaging stuff from above, and he has difficulties in looking through the iron. So he's looking in a quite different regime, in fact, just here in the clean system, than Stevens was doing. So the strong dependence, bias dependence of the lifetime, they do not find this here. But this is not surprising because they're really looking only here, far from the interface. And okay, the question is, if in the simple model you would expect that the sign of this accumulation should be opposite to that one, but it isn't. That, as I said, this could be many reasons for that. And I think Lou was telling us something about that or not. Are you going to talk about that?
No.
Okay. Okay, but I simply say I think it's a very difficult problem. I think there are many reasons which could cause that, and it would require lots of work to really find this out. Now, the interesting thing now is the electrical Hundley effect. So what they do is they, this is the experiment. They simply look at the voltage over the ferromagnet and the semiconductor while they're driving a current through the system, which induces the spin accumulation. Now, if by a magnetic field you are destroying the spin accumulation, basically, you find that the voltage over this contact changes in a way which seems to be proportional to the spin accumulation. And I tried to model these ones, but Paul told me I should not try. He strongly discourages theoreticians to model this curve because there are several complications. First of all, these sharp cusps here, I think you would not get by the simple theory. It seems to be the reason that there is some misalignment of the magnetic field causes nuclear spin polarization, which gives you some peak contribution at zero magnetic field. So I stopped trying to explain this in detail. But basically, I think the message is clear. And on Monday, there was a new experiment in which Paul really had sort of a number of contacts on the semiconductor, and he did non-local measurements of the spin accumulation in the same way as, for example, Bart van Wees did on the metal structures. And he really sees magnetization, orientation-related signals, which really confirm that he can really see the spin accumulation in the electrical, in an electrical way. Okay, and that sort of encourages us to really look whether we can see also the spin Hall effect by electrical means, by ferromagnetic contact. This is a picture of a workshop of last summer in Korea, which was organized by Heidel here. Now the work I'm going to talk about is sort of a collaboration. The main work has been done by Inanç Adagideli, and some interesting contributions by Bert Halperin, I will mention. Evgeny Eugene was also there here. yeah, that was a nice t-shirt which I got from Ani at some time indeed. Well, yeah. Okay, I can skip this crap. I guess everyone knows about what we're talking about here. I think from theory and experiment, we now believe that currents indeed can induce spin accumulations in semiconductors which have a significant spin-orbit interaction. These are usually a spin accumulation which is in plane of the bulk semiconductor. For the 2-DAG, Rushbar 2-DAG, this has been discussed, for example, by Edelstein some time ago. And we have this spin accumulations which are normal to the plane and at opposite sign at the edges. Now, both types of spin accumulations have been proven by shown by Kato et al. The in-plane contribution by this bump and probe experiment, and by direct imaging here of the edges for this other type of spin accumulations, which are out of the plane. And there are, of course, the experiments by Wunderlich et al. As well. Now, it's useful to discuss, or it's interesting to discuss this within the Rushbar Hamiltonian, and we've also heard a lot of it already. It's not always the most appropriate Hamiltonian, but it is the simplest one. So, as you know, this term here induces you a k-dependent spin splitting, and the sign depends on the direction, which means that this free electron gas is split in this way. And the eigenstates which correspond here to these two right-going branches correspond to spins which are polarized normal to the k-vector and then in opposite directions. So if you have a two-dimensional picture, you get this sort of Mexican hat with something, a cone on top, which we have also seen several times by now. Now, Junichi Inoue showed that this Rushbar 2-DAG has some disadvantage, that normal impurities, even weak impurities, destroy the bulk spin current in the 2-DAG. But what, of course, remains here is the in-plane spin accumulation. And Eugene has shown that you can get at the contacts, indeed, also spin accumulations are normal to the interface plane. And then Inanç showed that if you have any source of spin dissipation at the edges, then this will also create a spin accumulation out of the plane. Now, Inanç used diffusion equations, which are basically the same as Eugene's, and I think also Allen had derived this sort of set of equations, but then matched to the boundaries in some simple way. And the result is that you have at the edges not only spin accumulation in the I direction in plane, but also one in the z direction and with corresponding spin currents to that. Now, the reason is very simple. In the bulk, you have a pure s in-plane spin accumulation. If you have the gradient of the spin accumulation, you will get some spin diffusion to the edges. And since this moves in an effective pseudo-magnetic field, you will get some rotation out of the spin accumulation out of the plane. Now, what we'd like to do is, of course, to detect these accumulations experimentally, and the way to do that would be ferromagnetic contact. Now, it's quite interesting to think about the symmetry relations, because there was a little surprise here. Now, what you can use is to generalize the Onsager-Bütikofer type of relations for scattering geometry like that, in which we take one contact to be ferromagnetic with magnetization direction M. Now, the conductance parameters here in this multi-terminal type of formulas, they have to fulfill, obey this symmetry relation. Now, if you do this for a two-terminal configuration, then you will find that the conductance for the M direction must be the same as for the minus M direction. So this is a little bit surprising, because sort of you're generating a spin accumulation, for example, in an in-plane two-terminal configuration, and the conductance is the same whether this spin accumulation is parallel or anti-parallel to the ferromagnet. Now, this question came up during this Korea workshop and after a talk by Eugene. And a couple of days later, we got an email from Bert Halperin, who explained it for this special case of the point contact. And this is such a neat argument that I would like to repeat it here. Now, if you want to have any details, ask Eugene about that. Oh, can you see the curve? No, I hope. Now, assume that we have an adiabatic quantum point contact in the Rushbar 2, the electron gap, right? So we have, to the left, we have our dispersion of the Rushbar 2 deck, and here we have some potential hill. And we have two electrons which are right moving into the point contact. Now, what happens if they move in the point contact? Now, this goes adiabatically, the band structure goes up, right? And now, what happens here to the red point here? Now, it has no problem in going through this point contact. But what happens with the green one here? Now, an important point is that when you go into the point contact, you are confining the electrons laterally. So you get a finite momentum component normal to the plane. This means in this Mexican hat, you should not take the cut just in the center, but slightly off the center. Now, then you convince yourself that you will get here a gap between these branches. So this green one, when it comes closer to this point contact, it cannot jump down into this one here. But it will get a turning point here, and it will be reflected. And this reflection is accompanied by spin flip. But what we see here, the important point is now, we have really a fully spin polarized current just by having a single point contact. Okay? And now let's see what happens if we put a ferromagnetic contact upon that. Let's see, okay, we have a fully spin polarized current, so we should be able to detect this with a ferromagnet, right? Now let's figure this out. First of all, if we come in with the spin down, we have seen it is being reflected 100% by this point contact, the spin flip. Now the upspin, however, goes without any problem through the point contact. And let's assume for simplicity that our ferromagnet here is a half metal, and it's nicely matched to the interface, so there's a transmission of one, so it simply goes through. Now, what happens now if we reverse the ferromagnet? Right? Again, the spin down is reflected as before. But what happens with the spin up? Now, it goes through, and then it is reflected here at this interface. It goes back into the point contact. But then it has the same thing. What happens here? It's going to be reflected with combination with a spin flip, and it goes through. Right? So, for this simple model, we have now understood that indeed the conductance for up or down magnetization is exactly the same.
So that sounds like they put the derivative a little bit better. So, and usually a better doesn't mean
no, this is a very general one, but you see, the general argument was not very transparent in the beginning because we didn't understand what the physics is. This is a model, a simple model to understand the physics, and you can use the same model as well. Only have to take into account not only one reflection, but many reflections in order to understand the diffuse case. Right? Pardon me?
It looks like gravitational, like in the breath, or...
Pardon me? B?
There's a planet Q. So what I'm like, I was talking about...
No, exactly the same.
Same, I just didn't... There was X and minus somewhere.
No?
G of T equals G of minus. Oh, okay, fine.
If you change the magnetic field direction, you also should change your contacts.
Right, just so that's exactly the same as energy.
Yes, the general.
It should be pretty straightforward, right?
No, sort of. Maybe you find it straightforward, but at least we didn't find it straightforward, and Bert did not find it straightforward as well. At least he thought about this.
So but if I want to take home some seconds, then I can just replace M by T and everything will be fine.
Yes.
Okay. So what you're saying is that if you just look at the spin-off orbit panel volume, you might think that you would somehow violate this general thing,
yes.
Which is, you know, it's true.
Right.
Okay, and just so explicitly that we don't violate it.
Right, and I think there is a nice physics about it, which is multiple reflection at this interface. And this is, in fact, a strong analogy, I think, to the reflectionless tunneling in superconductivity. That's sort of the spin-up electron tries and it cannot penetrate, it goes back, it changes the phase by rotating in your spin orbit Hamiltonian, and it comes back. Then again, part of it is transmitted, the one which is transmitted goes back again and it does the same, comes back again. And you really have, if you take all these multiple scattering processes, you will find that indeed Onsager's relation is fulfilled. Okay, so yeah, it's you're right, it's not a big deal, but I found it nice. No.
when it scatters back, the scatters back, there is a kind of it follows the same trajectory, right?
Sort of between these impurity scatterings, it is precessing in your magnetic field and the precession direction and stuff. This depends on the K vector. And, yeah.
Right, but the second reflection, whether it's partial transmission, the second. Put it out.
This one.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So some goes through.
Some goes through, and some is being reflected, and it's again multiple reflected before it finally goes through as a downspin.
Right.
Yes.
Because you are not able to detect this.
Right. But there is hope. There's hope. Okay, so we can now look at different type of geometries just from this Onsager type relation type of things. And we can see, okay, what happens if we switch the magnetization in these different configurations like that. Now, in this case, we see we will get up or down, we will get the same signal. But from Onsager's relation, there is no reason why we should not be able to detect the spin Hall effect in a many terminal configuration, like that. Now, from symmetry point of view, it's completely equivalent to start with a ferromagnetic contact and inject a spin accumulation into your Rushbar or spin orbit region and then detect the voltage here. And I don't know whether you have seen CONTMAT yesterday, but there was a paper by Valenzuela and Tingham who had injection of spins by two ferromagnetic contacts here, and they observe a voltage about this bridge here. And they call this, that they observe the spin Hall effect. That's not completely correct to call it the spin Hall effect. it's an effect which is topologically equivalent to the spin hole effect, as far as the Onsager relations are concerned. And then, of course, this is, of course, nothing but the anomalous Hall effect. Right? Also, from symmetry point of view, the anomalous Hall effect is exactly the same as this one here or this one here. The only thing is that sort of the spin-up combination is here, just in the model itself. Okay? But, as I said, there is hope, because if you looked at my voltage meter and these two contact geometry, you saw that it was moving, it just went back. The point is that there is no difference between completely 180 degrees turned magnetization, but there is definitely a resistance signal as a function of the angle. Now, Inant has calculated this again, starting with the diffusion equation in the Rajpath 2 deck and the ferromagnetic contact with some simplified boundary condition. And the results turn out to be quite complex as a function of the angles phi and theta of the magnetization direction. So it depends strongly on the sort of whether you have a dirty or a more clean type of 2 deck, like here and here. And you see some interesting asymmetries like that. Now, sort of what we hope is that Paul Kroll is going to do these experiments and find something similar like that. But this would be sort of in the case of a pure, it's not a spin hole geometry, you can also calculate it for that, of course, but just in a two-terminal inline type of geometry. Now, another interesting effect is the prediction that this spin current induced spin accumulation can also exert a torque on the ferromagnet. Right? And this, again, turns out to be more complex than we expected. You see here the three components, X, Y, and Z, torque components on the ferromagnet, which is being exerted by the spin accumulation. Clearly, the TY component is the strongest one, as would be expected, because we have mainly spin accumulation, which is in the plane, and the y direction was in the plane. So we suggest that Hideo Ono, for example, should be able to observe the switching of the magnetization of the gallium manganese arsenide without having really to have a spin valve. It should be sufficient to just have a semiconductor and a ferromagnet.
Is it related to the fact that
Yes, that explains the anisotropy of the out of plane. Yes, right.
If they would be the same, there would be no torque. Is it correct?
No, there would still be a torque, but it would not be this. Would not be so asymmetric. Would not have this this strange topology here. Okay, so then we're already at the conclusions. I think you can read it yourself. And I have time. Yeah. Okay, thank you very much for your attention. I'm personally also not much interested in the spin current. I'm interested in the spin accumulation because that's the observable, right? So everything we showed here, we concentrated also on the spin accumulation and did not ask too many questions about what the spin current is, which gave that. But it's not so relevant, I suppose.
Okay, so the spin accumulation, is it easier to use the drive function, or you can use in the circuit, or?
Yes, because here you see the example. You can use this spin current induced in accumulation to switch magnetization. Right? Whether this is useful or not, I don't.
Well, in a friendly fashion, and so I mean, whether it's useless or not, of course, it's a good question, and maybe it's not obvious, but in a friendly fashion, what's useful? How can you use any of the optics stuff?
Can you wait another 5 minutes?
I mean, I think it would be good, of course, if.
Okay, I should modify what I said before. I think the spin current is not an interesting concept in diffuse systems. But I think in ballistic systems, it's not so clear. Because there you do not really have a semi-classical spin accumulation, but you still can have a spin current. I should be a bit careful, but I think in these type of dirty systems, and also in the metallic type of system, I think it's really the spin accumulation one should focus on. Yeah, but okay, but. I think simply the fact, I think you can really make a spintronic circuit without an electrical spintronic circuit without any ferromagnet. Now, for example, what I showed you, that if you have this point contact and a ferromagnet, then the ferromagnet is useless, or at least you really have to look at the angles.
But what you can do,
at least in principle, is have a point contact with alpha, and another point contact with plus alpha or minus alpha. Right? Two of these point contacts, they have exactly the same role as you have with the ferromagnet in one direction, ferromagnet in the other direction. So I think compared to quantum computing, it's a very useful concept.
But they're relatively small effects, let's say, compared to ferromagnets.
No, because I tried to show that according to Eugene, I think it's 100% polarized. So you really can get, if you have an alpha plus, an alpha minus point contact, you get 100% modulation of your current. So that is something which the ferromagnets have not yet realized, right? Because I think the real convincing application, spin valve effect with half metals, is not known to me. Of course, yeah, in the point contact, it still also has to be
demonstrated. Well, I think LSMO material, which is considered half metallic, has been used for spin valves.
Organic spin valves, yeah. No. Okay, no further questions, then I guess.
Question. Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
In those calculations you did with Sinaj, what were the boundary conditions between ferromagnet? And was there any interface resistance?
No.
So is there any resistivity mismatch?
No. So we assume there, and this is an approximation, which is in fact valid when the bulk resistances are much higher than the interface resistances. To simply say, okay, we indeed completely neglect that one. I guess
the
boundary conditions is still an unsolved problem. So I think we really have a very simplified set of
boundary conditions, which are valid in some limit, but certainly not general. So this is what Christian has to
be up.
So in the experiment by
Tinker, as you pointed out, you can think of it, in a mesoscopic system, maybe the distinction between the spin Hall effect and nominal Hall effect becomes philosophical.
Yes.
Hardly.
Right.
But do you have a feeling, maybe the issue in an experiment is the, let's say, skew scattering, for example. Is it occurring in the ferromagnet or in the aluminum? is that the issue in terms of whether you should think of it as a spin hall effect or
I sort of haven't really thought about that because I've just noticed this in CONMAT. I think whether you knew of it before and just printed it out. I see, right. but the fact that they're topologically the same, I think this occurred, of course, not only to us but other people as well. But I guess, of course, microscopically, there will be lots of interesting problems left, that's for sure.